seri ap kriye, yo seri men nan la joa. Men la vi pou mwen, se yon vre tragedie. Men la vi pou mwen, se yon vre tragedie.
Culture show.
Don't make me say it's so hot right now.
Your weekly dose of arts and culture
and all of that sort of stuff. It's that weird thing that they're classics because they're classics because they're classics, and then they become the classics and everyone wants to do the classics because they're classics.
He's amazing.
Well, you need a lot of room for all that blood.
And he's hot as a firecracker.
You're listening to So Hot Right Now. You better not use me saying that.
Amazing babes.
On 2SER 107.3.
Hello, hello, hello. You are listening to So Hot Right Now. My name is Sophie. Hoping you're having a cracking Saturday morning. It is certainly a gorgeous day for it. Now, oh, September is here. It started yesterday, and September also means it's fringe season. So we're going to be chatting with Kerry Glassick, who's director of Fringe Ignite, which is launching tonight, but she's also directing silent theatre. So we're going to be chatting to her all about that. Also, Blake Howard will be dropping in to chat a bit of gaggle of geeking, because you can't be too gaggle of geeking without Blake Howard. And there's heaps to talk about, including the wrap of Game of Thrones. Also, we are going to be chatting. There is going to be a citizens choir today. It starts from 1 p.m. and it's going to go for 24 hours. It's going to be part of This Is a Voice at the Powerhouse Museum. And we're going to be chatting to the composer behind that all. But to kick things off, here's a tune from Beer Jerk. This is from their Tragic LP. This one's called Another Drop. You're on So Hot Right Now with me, Sophie.
To me. Sydney Fringe 2017 is set to light up the streets again with the opening party, Fringe Ignite, this Saturday. Taking over Sydney's Kensington Street precinct in Chippendale, there'll be music, performance, spoken word, and best of all, it's completely free. Curated by the soulful and electric Nyree, come on down and feel the groove. 2SER is a proud media partner of Sydney Fringe Festival.
And speaking of Fringe, we actually have director of the Sydney Fringe Festival on the line now. Kerry, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you going? Very exciting. Fringe Ignite tonight.
This afternoon, a matter of hours away. That's right. It's very exciting. Our big opening at Kensington Street at our festival village this year. Curated by Nyree, which will be amazing. We've got 9 stages and 4 hours of music, all free.
There you go. It's all happening. Your Saturday entertainment done. But we are here to talk actually about silent theatre. And silent theatre, it's one of those rare events where audiences are invited to eavesdrop on 4 different playwrights. So where did this idea come from and how did it all start?
It's been an idea that's been brewing for a little while. In fact, it's built off something we did last year, which was a project we called Chain Play. And we partnered with the Urban Hotel, which is a great hotel in Newtown, and we placed 4 playwrights in consecutive nights in the same hotel room, and they had to stay a night in the hotel room and write a quarter of a script, and then they left it there for the next playwright, and they carried it on, and then at the end we did a staged reading, and it was fantastic and heaps of fun. And this year we were talking to the hotel about doing it again and maybe taking it to the next level, and that's how the Silent Theatre Project came about. So the plan this year is we have 4 adjoining rooms that all have balconies side by side, and our writers and creatives have spent a night in each room, and they've created their own scene set in their room, and then we're now in the process of working those up with actors and musicians and creatives, and, pardon me, in a couple of weeks you'll be able to buy a ticket and see the works. But the plan is that audiences stand on the street with headphones and they can watch and catch the drama across the street on the balconies and in the rooms, but they can hear all the intimate conversations going on. So the idea is that it's a nice, it's an opportunity to, exactly what you said, eavesdrop into a hotel room. Who doesn't want to find out what's going on in those hotel rooms at night? But also to have a connection with intimate conversations and really private moments in the middle of a bustling city. And I love this idea of the audience hanging out on Emore Road, which is so busy, and yet they're engaged with these really quiet, beautiful conversations. That's the plan anyway. We'll see if it works.
I mean, like, I love that idea too, but Edmore Road, as you mentioned, it is so busy and so loud. I live right off it.
The only thing we've got to worry about are buses. Everything's else okay. We've been testing it over the last few months, so we're pretty confident we'll be okay, but it'll be a wild adventure anyway.
So logistically, how will it work? So people just go by, come in?
Yeah, so you need to book your tickets, and tickets, you come and meet at the hotel, have a drink, hang out, and then one of our guides will take you across the street, and there's a designated spot to sit, to stand, where you can have perfect view of the balconies. And then, yeah, the show only goes for an hour. Each room is about, 15 minutes with things that cross over as well, to join the stories together. And you'll be able to watch and see what happens.
What kind of elements of the production do you think will surprise audiences? Like, is it the conversations, do you think, that are so intimate that are coming out of these rooms?
Yeah, it's definitely going to be content. But I think it is, technically it's quite a challenging project to do, because you do have all those environmental issues like noise and light and other things. And also you are trying to translate a story across a road, and up two floors. So there's interesting logistical hurdles, but I think if we can pull them off, which I'm sure we can because we've been researching and practicing, it will be quite magnificent, because what you have is the ability to play with the idea of, well, first of all, the audiences can hear us no matter whether they can see us or not. So all the actors are mic'd. So you might have a couple who are laying in bed and you can't even see them yet, but you can hear them and hear what's going on. And then they may come out on the balcony. You might carry on the story outside. So you have the ability to drop little suggestions which are physical only, so that actors can be in the middle of their story and you're not even listening to what they're doing yet while you're listening to someone else, but you're able to watch what's happening as well. So I'm hoping when it all comes together is that there'll be lots of stories that are pieced together that all reveal themselves at the very end. That is what I'm hoping. I'm hoping it will be very exciting. But like any new things and world firsts and concepts that haven't been done before, there's always an element of risk. But that's half the fun of an audience as well.
Absolutely. I mean, something so interactive as well. It's just like what goes, goes.
Yeah.
But tell me about a bit more about the playwrights that you chose to be involved in this production.
So Benjamin Law, who's one of our ambassadors this year, who most people know from his columns in Good Weekend and also My Family Law, his show on SBS. He's writing one of our pieces. And Emmy May, who is an emerging playwright, she's fantastic, is writing one of the others. Then we have musician Brian Campau, who's writing a bunch of songs and selecting some things for one of the rooms, because there will be a musical element. And then myself and Michael Piggott, who are a part of the old 505 Theatre Company, we're devising a piece as well set around the hotel room. So there's a whole team of us. And, it's really exciting.
Yeah. I mean, that's an amazing lineup, but everyone, they're quite different disciplines. So how does that kind of all come together in a way to make one production?
Yeah, that's a little bit of a challenge as well. But that, again, you know, challenges are always an opportunity. I'm the eternal optimist. That's one of the great things about having Brian Campau on board. And I think music's going to play a huge key in tying the stories together. And also, the Michael and I are working, because our piece is devised and we work a lot, we're working around the other scripts that have been, that are quite more solid and less flexible. So we're hoping that our piece, we're able to thematically join the other two together. Yeah.
I think it will work out fine. It sounds amazing. I mean, who doesn't want to see theatre on a balcony?
I know. It's so exciting. Well, I think, look, that's the wonderful thing about the Sydney Fringe Festival. And increasingly, as we grow in profile and make more connections in the community, we're able to do those sorts of things that are quite difficult to do in Sydney, really. Mm. You know, and so we get the opportunity to be able to, you know, put theatre on the street, on balconies, or to take over warehouses and to do great, crazy things that Sydney creatives often don't get to do at other times of the year. So it is a rare opportunity, and I encourage everyone to get out there and see some of this great immersive and site-specific stuff that we've got in the program this year.
For sure. Well, Kerry, thank you so much for joining us here on It's So Hot Right Now, and all the best to Ignite tonight.
Thanks so much, and I hope to see you at Silent Theatre.
Hope to see you there too. Well, we will be there. Oh, my mind is spiraling on a Saturday morning.
I know, it's early.
Well, all the best, and thanks for chatting to us again.
Have a lovely day.
You too. That was Sydney Fringe Festival director Kerry Glassick giving us a bit of a sneak peek into Silent Theatre. It'll be showing on the 19th to the 21st of September at the Urban Hotel just on Enmore Road near the beginning. You can get all the details at sydneyfringe.com, or even easier on the 2SER website, just 2SER.com, and click through to So Hot Right Now. I'm going to jump back into the music now. Here's a tune from the John Spencer Blues Explosion. This is from Freedom Tower, No Wave Dance Part. It's called Tales of Old New York, The Rock Box.
In the 90s, when we were...
A lot of people from the scene and all our friends got...
I mean, with Blues Explosion, we're live.
We really wanted to push the music there. You know, we wanted to get way out there.
Yeah, nothing matters except...
I got a rock box, baby! Down in New York City! So pretty.
Yeah.
That didn't wake you up, don't know what will. That was the John Spencer Blues Explosions with Tales of New York, The Rock Box. You're here on So Hot Now with me, Sophie Lai. But now it's time for...
To the Batmobile.
Let's go. Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
Roger. Ready to move out.
Holy smokes, Batman. It's Gaggle of Geeks with...
Blake Howard?
And Sophie Lai.
Good morning, Blake Howard of Graffiti with Punctuation.
Good morning, Soph. How are you?
Great. Sad, but great.
A surprise in-studio recording today.
Hello.
Hello.
This is nice.
This is very nice. Yeah, look, it's been a big week. It's been like, and for a bunch of reasons, and it just seems that on a Friday, like it's Saturday morning, it's beautiful sunny Saturday, and on Friday, just a car crash of awesome shit to talk about. Just always happens. So, look, the big one that we want to talk about, because we're both extremely behind it, Ed Skrein, who played Ajax in Deadpool.
Amazingly.
Just got, was basically the butt of... the butt of a thousand jokes. He was cast in the upcoming Hellboy reboot, playing a character in what's called the BPRD, but the character in the comic books was actually a guy with Agent's Ascent. And... immediately, the internet blew up, as it does, because this is a really important... representation is hugely important, and especially with established, you know, comic book or cartoon characters, we want, you know, we want that representation to hold through in the casting.
Absolutely.
And Ed Skrein did probably one of the most noble and cool things this week. He stepped away from the role.
And it was funny, because just last week, when everyone was like, the hell, why did you cast this guy in this role when he's not even of Asian descent... the producer's like, we stand behind our decision. He's a great fit for this role. And then, like, a week later, he's like, wait, what?
Yeah.
I'm supposed to be Asian?
Oh, yeah, I'm going to read this beautiful quote. Like, he said it best. He goes, it's clear that representing this character in a culturally accurate way holds significance for people. And to neglect that responsibility would continue a worrying tendency to obscure the ethnic minority stories and voices in arts. I feel it's important to honor and respect that. Therefore, I've decided to step down from the role so it can be cast appropriately. Like, wow.
It's not hard.
No, but it's so, this is really cool because online, if you look at Ed Skrein, because he, you know, he posted it on Twitter, you see thousands of people who have retweeted him, who have said, you've got a fan for life. I'll see you in any film after this decision. I think it's just such a, it's such a cool thing. And it's like, sometimes it's up to the performers themselves. Like, do I want to do this? And drag a film that doesn't need the controversy into more controversy when we can just cast another great, ethnically appropriate actor to do the gig.
I know, it's not hard. And when people are like, what's he talking about, this mixed heritage bit, when he's talking about, you know, I have family of mixed heritage, I was like, what? Yeah. It's like, well, his son is of mixed race, is biracial. And it's like, well, if he's going to be a good role model for his son, of course he will step down.
Yeah, like, really good stuff.
Fantastic.
Now, from something that's really great representation to the first of... is a car crash of us talking about buns this morning on Gaggle of Geeks.
So we're talking about the front buns first, right?
front buns. Evangeline Lilly has shown up on the 100th birthday, or what would have been the 100th birthday, of Jack Kirby, the infamous Marvel artist, titan in the Marvel universe. And to celebrate, a whole bunch of people said a lot of nice stuff about him online. But one of the cool things was Evangeline Lilly, who's the Wasp, showed the internet her costume as the Wasp, and she's got booby armor.
It's like, you got to protect the assets. She's got great boob armor.
It's like some of the best boob armor that we've ever seen.
No nipples. No bat nips.
No bat nips, but some certainly good booby armor, so that was good.
It looks great. It's shaping up nicely.
Yeah, look, she was the best thing about Ant-Man, to be honest.
Very true.
So the fact that she's getting double billing this time... is good, and I think it actually probably plays to Paul Rudd's strength. Like, if he gets to play kind of the guy who's meant to be the guy in charge but is really the sidekick, I think that that works for him.
I feel like he's not leading man. He plays better off the people he's around.
100%.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just watch This Is 40 when he says, Fred, he's very good. The other big one is, and look, this is huge news for you and I because we're massive Batman fans, so... Brenton Thwaites is an Aussie actor who's been cast in a stack of stuff. Most recently, the god-awful, absolutely mess.
Gods of Egypt.
Oh, no. I was talking about Pirates of the Caribbean.
Oh, both. There's been two things. He's been two terrible films he's been cast in.
He's been cast in. He's actually not quite... He's not a bad actor at all, actually. No. He's a very decent actor. He's been cast as Dick Grayson, as Nightwing in the upcoming Titans adaption that's going straight to DC TV, essentially. And I think it's CW it is. Am I right to say it's CW?
It probably will be, since they hold most of the... All the actual Legends of Tomorrow, Supergirl,
yeah.
The Flash, Arrow, they hold all those things. But that DC TV will also have all the animated stuff, including New Teen Titans.
Yeah, so he's going to be starring as Dick Grayson in Titans. Very important casting for Nightwing to have great buns. And Brenton Thwaites, he's got those buns. Do you approve, Soph?
He does not have those buns.
Oh, no.
Are you kidding? He's very pretty, which I appreciate. But Maria, former gaggler, along with the amazing Nicola Scott, who drew Dick in Teen Titans, used to draw him with the most luscious set of buns.
Yes.
And then we all just looked and went like, oh, kid's going to need padding if they're filming next month. He's going to need some padding.
Start squatting now.
Squat hard, because, I mean, Kit Harington, if he can do it, you can too.
Listen.
Squat.
Great segue. We're heading into the delightful peach that was the final episode of Game of Thrones, this series. We just a little tiny spoiler warning, because if you're not one of the fans of Game of Thrones... I mean, I don't know how you've missed it, but...
I mean, it was buntastic. It was just memes of buns everywhere.
Yeah, if you haven't seen the episode, you've seen the buns by now, surely. Look, last episode of Game of Thrones, Soph, what do you think of the season?
It's been really epic. I wasn't... Compared to last season, though, where I was actually, like, gasping for air, like, it didn't have that amount of, you know, just trying to, like, screaming moments, but this season it was definitely really solid for me.
Yeah, I think for me it's an excellent season, because so much of what we've been has been like knife edge tension and political sort of backstabbery has like ended, and this season feels like a greater than Lord of the Rings length epic sort of conclusion. It's rolling into a conclusion.
The other thing is, this has been a happy season.
Pretty much. We've been being rewarded. Our characters we like aren't dead.
I know. It's just, I think that's why I'm like, this is a bit strange. Because I didn't have the words to say it before. But yeah, this has been a nice season. We've had a Stark reunion, something we've been waiting for six seasons for.
Daenerys is finally on Westeros.
Daenerys is in Westeros.
Bran's back at Winterfell as well.
Yep. Yeah, all the Starks are together. You know, Brienne is like, you know, reminiscing with the Hound of how great their murder child is. It's just like, it's all come together. And it's like, no one that we really loved died. Like,
yet.
It's still to come. We've been rewarded when, like, you know, when they're like, there was this moment.
I think in seconds of this season, the appearance of the Night King has told us that this happy little holiday that we've been on for eight episodes is not going to last very long.
I know, but there's like, when they went beyond the wall, you thought, holy shit, they're going to kill off some really good faves. And then you're like, no, not that one. And they didn't. And you're like, oh, this is a bit strange.
Yeah.
This is just a bit strange that you killed the one that everyone's like, oh, yeah, we liked him, but not that much.
Yeah. So, look, I really like this season. I think it's paying off. And I think we can't get greedy. Fans, I just want to say to all Game of Thrones fans, like, the entire Lord of the Rings franchise, including the terrible third Hobbit movie, first two Hobbits, so I actually really enjoyed, but and then the OG Lord of the Rings, is not, like, it's like 2.5 seasons of Game of Thrones. Like, you've got now 7 incredible series of this, and the most recent series is, like, hour and a half length episodes at the drop of a hat. It's such amazing... a breadth of story on TV. So I think it's like, that's going to be the decision in a couple of years, is like, what did fantasy better, and is it Tolkien or is it Game of Thrones, basically?
I feel like Tolkien was the 2000s era.
And this is our decade, yeah.
This is the
Yeah, pre-2000s. Up to that point, it was pretty much there. Yeah, 2001, 2002, 2003, I think they were. But yeah, so this is our decade. But it's just amazing how it's translated. And it's going to leave such a yawning gap on TV when it goes.
Yeah, because we have to wait like nearly 2 years for the next one.
I'm okay with that. I'm okay with two years because when you think about it, like I remember like Peter Jackson filmed the original Lord of the Rings series over like
3 years.
All in one go. For three movies. And
that made sense because he made three fantastic movies out of it.
Exactly. But one series of Game of Thrones is longer than those. So if we only have to wait 2 years, and as you've seen, like progressively originally some of the, you know, special effects don't traditionally age well. And you see in some of the earlier series, some of the special effects, they didn't lean on them as much because I don't think they had as much faith in the special effects. But now you just only have to look at, like, getting up close and personal with a dragon.
Well, it's like now it's like you can't have little baby dragon no more. You have to have a freaking huge,
a gigantic. Oh, my God.
And then, like, in the first season, it's like, dire wolf puppies. We can use real puppies. Now it's like we ran out of budget to do ghost.
Yes, yeah. It's massive. It's massive. So, look, I'm super excited. I really enjoyed this season. There's lots to come. Mm. There's lots of cool, weird theories. There is one quick theory because we've only got a couple of minutes before we should wrap, but there's one quick theory, which is the Brandon Stark is the Night King theory. Mm. You know, yeah, I think we might need to put spoilers ahead of this again, but fans out there are thinking that Brandon Stark, who survived outside the wall and who's the three-eyed raven, is in fact
the Night King.
What do you think?
I don't know, because everyone's always looking at those little bits of symbolism, and when the Night King is marching into Westeros after he breaks down the wall, the formation that they make is of a direwolf sigil that is the House of Stark.
Yes.
And after Jon got stabbed a couple of seasons ago and was dying and his blood ran out, apparently that looked like a dragon. I didn't see it then, but people were like, it looked like a dragon. And now look, he is a Targaryen.
So, yeah, look, I'm really interested to see where this is going. I think that, I don't know if he is the Night King, but there's something really squirrely about him being the three-eyed raven.
I think since the Night King touched him, there is a connection.
Yes.
Like,
getting your freaking Horcrux on.
Oh, totally. There is a Horcrux situation happening. I think there's still two separate entities, but they are unaware that they have a little Horcruxy connection.
Love that. Horcruxy connections. Horcruxy connections and buns. That's the episode.
Buns, 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 buns. We might leave it at that because I'm going back into creepy territory.
We dragged us out into Horcruxes, but now into creep. But, guys, thanks so much for listening to this week's Gaggle of Geeks.
We'll catch you next week, Blake. More gaggling.
Thanks, Saf. And, guys, if you want to check out my new extremely geeky podcast called One Heat Minute, it's at oneheatminute.com, and Soph is going to be a guest on there soon. It is traveling through all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's movie Heat 1 minute at a time. I'd love if you could check it out.
Thanks, Blake. Catch you then.
Bye.
Bye.
Sorry for the little crappy audio that our mics just did not work right then. But you can catch all of Blake's reviews on graffitiwithpunctuation.com. Just listen back to all our Gaggle Geeks on 2SER.com or follow us on Twitter at Blake is Batman and at 2SER. Coming up, very exciting, we're going to be chatting about a 24-hour choir, a citizen choir, which means you can get involved. Plus, we're going to talk about a new production called Urban Kali that's coming up. But first, here's a tune from the Man of Smooth. This is Maya Hawthorne with Handyman.
I can be your handyman. I can be your helping hand. And I will gladly
that, there was You Can Have Me by Sister Jane. On top of that, you heard from the Man of Smooth, Maya Hawthorne, with Handyman. You're here on So Hot Right Now with me, Sophie Lai. I hope you're having a cracking morning. And if you are out and about today, you should head on down to the Sydney Observatory at 1 p.m. because a massive 24-hour citizens' choir is happening. It's all part of This Is a Voice exhibition at the, from the Museum of Applied Arts and Sciences. And joining you on the line to tell you more is artist and composer Julian Day. Good morning, Julian.
Good morning.
So this is part of massive exhibition at the Powerhouse Museum, This Is a Voice. How did this all come together?
Well, the exhibition has, this is its second iteration, actually. It was at the Wellcome Collection in London a couple of years back, and now it's having its Australian iteration with a lot of local artists, among them Kusum Normoyl, Agatha Goethe-Snape, Christian Thompson, Lawrence English, and myself, Julian Day. It's just a really interesting compendium of different approaches to the human voice through medical objects, through historic works, and through a bunch of contemporary pieces. And what I've contributed is this performance, which is happening today and tomorrow.
Yeah. So how did what is Supercritical Mass, and how did they get involved in the project?
So Supercritical Mass is a project that I co-direct. We've been running about a decade or so, and basically it's a way for people to come together in different public locations and use sound as a way to not only understand our social connection, but also our relationship to space and different locations. So it all began with a large-scale performance at Carriage Works back in 2008, which was about 80 flutes all swirling through the building and really enjoying that really lush reverberance.
Wow.
And since then, we've worked in really diverse locations. We've had a brass army around the lake of Central Park in New York. We've flooded Manchester Cathedral with voices. We've done kind of rogue events in like Martin Place, Hyde Park, even Mitchell Library at the State Library. Always using the one kind of sound source, whether it's musical, like a flute, whether it's the maybe everyday objects. So kicking bowls around actually creates a really amazing sound, a kind of bowl orchestra. Mm-hmm. And in this case, human voice, which is a very elemental way to understand sound and our personal connections.
Yeah, so this one, it's human voice. So how will you direct this 24-hour choir?
Yeah, my heart rate's starting to go up as I fully realize just what I've got myself into. So it's a very simple process, actually. You don't need to do much collectively to create quite a rich vocal sound. Basically, when people come along, they learn three or four very simple instructions. They step inside the rotunda, which is this octagonal sheltered space just on the north side of Sydney Observatory, up on the hill, overlooking the harbour and North Sydney and Lavender Bay. And you join the choir as it is at that point, and you contribute your own very simple sounds, like long notes. You harmonize with others, you harmonize against them. And just over time, the harmony actually shifts and changes, reflecting how community is shifting and changing at that one moment.
So basically, if someone slightly changes the tone, most people will go along with it?
Basically, yes. You either pitch in with someone else, or you throw in a new note, or try and go against them in some way. And you also move every so often into a different position. So you're always getting an ever-changing configuration of the people. And basically, then what you're hearing over the course of time that you're there, let's say you're there for half an hour or an hour, you'll hear that sound really quite radically change as different people ebb and flow. So it's kind of, as I say, a harmonic study into community.
Yeah. Now, this is happening at the Sydney Observatory in the Rotunda, as you mentioned. How does sound reverb off that?
Well, in two ways. There's actually a really steep pitched ceiling on top of the rotunda, which creates quite a rich resonance when you're in there. It's quite marked. When you walk through the park, walk up the steps and step inside, your voice actually resonates really well. It's like being in a big bathroom. But the other thing about that, so that bounces and ricochets off the ceiling to some extent, but because on all sides it's actually open, you're also getting the sounds of the city. You're getting a 360-degree panoramic oral understanding of the city. So you're also not only tuning in with the people with you, but you're also tuning in against the traffic, thrumming its way towards North Sydney. You're hearing the sound of ferries and their occasional horns. You're hearing birds towards the latter part of the day as they rest in the tree. And people just enjoying the park. It's a pretty active park. There's no doubt going to be several weddings going on. In fact, I can see some wedding photography right now. It's just a very unique way to understand the sound of our city, I guess.
Yeah. Does wind play any role in this? Because that bend can get quite windy up there.
It can. It's not predicted to be particularly windy this weekend. In fact, it's the perfect time of year. We're sort of, you know, the first weekend of spring, and I'm standing here right now, and I'm in a T-shirt. It's actually a lovely day. It can get a bit windy on the hill, but not so much in that rotunda. For some reason, I think the trees really break it. So we're quite sheltered. But I guess what the wind does do is it actually brings in those other sounds, the porous nature of the city. And particularly, I was here last night at about 11 o'clock just listening and doing a bit of solo singing. And it's really quite remarkable how much you can absorb through, I guess, the travelling nature of sound in and around you.
Now, 24 hours, how will you sustain these vocal harmonies overnight?
Well, we've actually had quite a bit of interest for some of the more bizarre times of the night. We have quite a few people seem to have signed up for 1 a.m. for some reason. But I think, you know, as we know, Sydney tends to close at about 1 a.m. So maybe that's why. Some people are actually choosing to catch the last train up from Wollongong, walk up the hill from Circular Quay, and then get back home on the first train. So they're kind of carrying it through the night. The piece actually works for even just a handful of people. It's actually quite charming hearing yourself in a duet or a trio with others, particularly, as I say, against the bed of the ambience of the city. But the rotunda can fit up to 20 or 30 people in it at any one time. So part of it is the ebb and flow, where sometimes it's me, you, and two other people. At other times, it's quite a full-throated community choir all going off at once.
So do you have to sign up or can anyone join?
Anyone can join. That's the beauty of the project. And it's something that's always driven me with this project. I'm classically trained and I've always been indoctrinated into the idea of the orchestra as being one of the big things that you do as a composer. But let's face it, they can be pretty exclusive. And so what I wanted to do was to try and open up the idea of an orchestra to let anyone join. So we're not only in a very porous oral location here, but we're also trying to create a very porous community structure. And so really, you don't need any particular vocal training. You simply come in and you let your natural voice guide you. And there's absolutely no right or wrong with this. There are three or four parameters that you keep in mind, a few instructions. But besides that, it's what people bring to the choir is what generates the energy and the actual content. So, yeah, it's really just rock up when you choose to. Pick your favorite time of day. Come a bit later and see how it's shifted. Come again in the morning and see how it's changed yet again with a different bunch of people.
I mean, you are in the heart of the city, so I'm like wondering if any like late night revelers were like, "Oh, what's this sound? Come and join."
Well, it was getting a little raucous in the park last night as I was doing my solo singing. There's quite a few people actually who kind of come up and take in the view, either to do some photography, or they're a little romantic, or they're just a bunch of people having a small get together. So I think it's going to blur in with those sounds and those little micro communities as well. And who knows, maybe they'll come up and learn the instructions and join us too.
Sounds like a fantastic project. All the best today, Julian. But thank you so much for talking to us today on So Hot Right Now.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Julian Day there. You can join all the harmonising at the Sydney Observatory today from 1 p.m. And, you know, it goes on till 1 p.m. tomorrow, so plenty of time for you to join. We'll pop all those details up on 2ocr.com along with this podcast. We're going to jump back into the music now. Here's a tune from Chris Wiseman. This one's called Thorn from the album The Holy Life That's Coming.
Have you ever heard that melody before? Or is your lifelong consolation that you did more? Did you tear your mother away from the cartoon store? They don't let Michael hold you anymore. No. the basic promise not to eat streets. Did you tear your faith away from the chorus complete? Now every confrontation is a treat. No. But I don't wanna lose my seat. Did you ever go? Did you ever know? Did you ever go down here? Okay, you have, but why wasn't I there? I bet you've heard that melody before. Or is your lifelong consolation that you heard more? Did you tear your father away from the family floor? They don't let Michael hold you anymore. So I'm hungry to taste that thorn.
Galleries, libraries, archives, museums. Glam City, 2SER's new series, gives you the latest on Sydney's events and exhibitions. Join historians Tamsin Peach and Anna Clark to find out what's going on in Sydney's cultural scene. Listen live Mondays at 7pm or download Glam City on your podcast app today. Stories, ideas, music. 2SER 107.3.
Say
out there was Brain Freeze by Bully here on at 2SEL 107.3. You're listening to So Hot Right Now, your weekly dose of art and culture. Now, Rikini Devi is the fearless goddess Kali in her production of Urban Kali. Rikini is a creator and performer hailing from Kolkata and bringing traditional Indian dance forms to the Sydney stage at last. Her fight against misogynistic attitudes is something of a long life mission, using the mysticism of Kali to celebrate the divine feminine. And she joins you now on the line. Good morning.
Good morning, Sophie. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm well.
Now,
thank you for that introduction. I just wanted to point out that I'm not actually bringing Indian classical dance to the stage at all. It's a very contemporary work.
Mm-hmm.
I do draw on my background of Indian classical dance for my, you know, performance vocabulary. But there's nothing traditional or, you know, about the work.
So how is it kind of like using those traditional forms and kind of translating it into a more contemporary form?
Well, that's the subject of my doctoral study at the moment at the University of Wollongong. I'm in the final year of a doctorate, which is called Urban Kali, From Sacred Dance to Secular Performance. And basically, I've spent the last two decades using aspects of Indian classical dance to create my own choreography and performance to address different issues, and also just, you know, to create abstract performance.
Yeah, and, you know, the Hindu religion is made up of so many gods and goddesses, so, mm-hmm. which is, you know, very based in religion. So who is the goddess Kali, and how do you kind of separate that into the secular?
Right. Well, the goddess Kali, who, you know, dominates the deities in Kolkata, and I grew up with her iconography. I mean, basically, over the last few years, especially when I've been doing a lot of durational performance art, I find, and also in addressing misogynist behaviors and atrocities in India, which is a subject I've been addressing in my arts work over the last two decades as well. The goddess Kali, with her fierce iconography, she represents change, time, death. You know, it's a fierce iconography, and I can't think of anyone better to use as a protest against, you know, female shame that is prevalent in Indian culture.
How important is symbolism like Kali in Indian culture?
Well, you know, the whole of Indian culture is saturated in symbolism. As a whole, and of course I draw heavily on my Indian classical dance background, where all our gestures and the whole vocabulary comes from sacred texts, which have been shrouded in, you know, mystical symbols, in the bodies, gestures, poems, poetry, literature. And like European, you know, mythology as well. I mean, Hindu mythology is rich with all these beautiful symbolisms that represent different aspects of humanity. And so it's somewhere that it's a resource that, you know, many artists from my background obviously draw on.
And Urban Kali, it's your fourth dance production focusing on the goddess Kali.
Mm-hmm.
So how has that kind of evolved, your journey amongst each dance production?
Right. Well, so this is the Urban Kali is the fourth full-length dance theatre work that I've made in the past 27 years. And basically, this form is like a collage format of dance, visual art, film. I'm working with sound artist Carl Ford from Melbourne, who's creating the sound and the film. I also use my own visual art and installation. So it's a very multidisciplinary work. And basically my approach to sort of performing Hindu goddess iconography, or in this case, performing Kali iconography, you know, and dismantling Indian classical dance modes into contemporary vocabulary, etc., is done by usually exaggerating these themes in order to highlight, you know, certain nuances of the form.
Mm.
And you know, by experimenting and subverting all of these gestures, I still work within the framework of a traditional structure. So basically what I refer to it is using tradition as transgression.
Right.
So by you know, so it's not denying the value of tradition, it's honoring the tradition of my heritage and of both dance and my own personal heritage through ritual and dance.
As you mentioned, it's a very multidisciplinary production. So how do
yes.
the installations and the film and the sound play into the overall dance element?
Well, obviously you'll have to come and see it. I mean, at the moment I'm steeped in rehearsals. This has gone through many stages since the last couple of years. And, you know, it's grown slowly. I mean, the difference of making this work to any other work is usually as an independent artist, you're given, like, you know, a very short time to produce something.
Mm.
In this case, because it's been working at the same time as my doctoral studies, I've had time to examine and analyze and you know, I've worked through journals and drawings and paintings, and that's how I've worked, you know, mostly throughout the last two decades of my work. But it's developed, you know, slowly through very, you know, through very different channels, and like editing, you know, a large essay, it's gone through many stages of editing, and the final product will, I suppose, be revealed in 3 weeks' time.
Because you worked so closely with it in your doctorate, did it change direction in a way that you didn't expect to?
It did, really, because you're influenced by, you know, I mean, I've always worked with written word, from text, from, you know, but in this case, because I'm questioning things and because I'm analyzing and reflecting on my own process, it's obviously made a difference. On the same token, it's, you know, it's not, it has still retained the elements. I mean, basically, it's performance. I don't want it to have, you know, just this intellectual aspect to it. It's very much a physical, emotional, passionate, artistic.